This evening, we appreciate the presence of everyone. We again have visitors, and we're glad that you've come and hope you can come back and be with us again. We're finishing a series tonight, as we did this morning. We finished a different series. This evening, we're finishing a series on fellowship. As I've already mentioned, I am to be in Oklahoma City next Lord's Day beginning for a lecture program along with Jerry Feit. He'll be one of the lecturers on the program, and he is to be dealing throughout the week on 1 John as it threads with fellowship, and I'm dealing with the subject of fellowship for 5 lessons. And so we want to conclude tonight by making some application to all of that, but I want to review where we've been. But to start with this principle here, and that is the importance of fellowship. Why is fellowship important? Fellowship is important because 3 John says that if we refuse to have fellowship with those we should, we're wrong. 2 John teaches if we extend fellowship to those we should refuse it to, we're wrong. And so consequently, fellowship is important. In the first of these 5 lessons, we raised the question, what is biblical fellowship? Our conclusion from 2 Corinthians 6 was, seeing how the term fellowship, koinonia, was used, it had reference to the agreement and principle that leads to joint or common action in spiritual work. We'll say more about that here in just a moment. In the second study, we talked about fellowship in the truth. That is, we talked about the basis for unity is truth. The basis for fellowship is truth. The basis for rejecting people from fellowship is truth. Truth is the basis for accepting or rejecting one into fellowship or out. In the third lesson, we talked about Romans 14. The point of Romans 14 is to agree to disagree over the kind of issue in Romans chapter 14. That is, we continue fellowship in spite of differences. We saw that the kind of difference there was matters of indifference or Christian liberty, not matters of faith and doctrine. And then in the last study, we talked about 2 John 9, there are those whom we are not to receive. 2 John 9 says that there are some that are not to be received. Our conclusion from that is that there are 3 that were condemned in the context of 2 John, and that is one who practices sin or error, one who teaches error, and one who receives or accepts or fellowships the teacher of error. Those 3 are condemned in 2 John. Now tonight I want to talk about applications to controversy. Applications of the principles to controversy. I want to suggest to you that we must learn how to take Bible principles and apply them properly to both current and future controversies. And so as issues arise among brethren, and there have been for years and years and years, there'll be some issue to arise. Is this a scriptural practice? And how are we going to approach that? Every time an issue arises, Romans 14 comes to play. Somebody will apply that. Somebody else will apply 2 John 9. And so how do you take these principles and apply them to both current and future controversies? I want to suggest to you that it's possible to learn one without learning the other. And it's possible to learn the other without learning the one. And here's what I mean by that. There's such a thing as a principle and application. It's possible that we can learn the principles without learning properly how to apply the principles. It's also possible that we could learn the application without understanding the principle behind that. For example, when issues arose in the church a number of years ago, for example, in the institutional controversy of the 50s and 60s, I'm convinced that coming out of those controversies of the 50s and 60s, were some who learned the principle of Bible authority, but they really never learned how to apply that principle. Well, if you know a principle, but you don't know how to use it, it's not very helpful to you. On the other hand, there were some who learned the application. They learned that certain things were wrong. The church is not to support these organizations, but they didn't understand the principle of Bible authority behind that. So consequently, in either case, when another issue arises, they're in trouble. So we've got to take the principles and know how to apply the principles, and that's what part of our study is about tonight. 4 things we're going to consider in our study. We're going to look at some principles that must be applied. We're going to look at some instructions that must be followed. We're going to see efforts that must be resisted and warnings that must be heeded. And that wraps up our study with reference to fellowship. Let's start with this. Let's talk about principles that must be applied. We've been talking about principles for 4 studies. And let's talk about how we apply those principles to both current and future controversies. First of all, I want us to consider the fact that actions must be based upon authority. Our actions must be based upon authority. Here is the principle that we must know and we must learn. We must know and learn the principle that we must respect Bible authority. Let's go to Hebrews 8 and verse 5. Here is an old principle. We need to know the principle. We need to know how to apply the principle. The point in Hebrews 8 and verse 5 is talking about present application in the day of Paul to a principle that was as old as Moses himself. And that is that God had said to Moses concerning building of the tabernacle, see that you make all things according to the pattern. The point in the context is that was a type and a shadow, or a model, if you please, of the greater to come. So that which was the type or the model or the shadow of the greater to come was to be built according to the pattern. The point is, if that had to be according to the pattern, the tabernacle, how much more so the real and the true? Now let me illustrate. Suppose you're about to build a house and you go to the architect and he draws plans or a pattern for building the house. And so you're wondering how this house is going to look, so you go to a model maker and you ask the model maker, build me a model just like the pattern says. What do you mean? Well, if there's a garage, I want you to put a garage. If it has a chimney, I want you to put a chimney. If it has a 412 or 512 pitch, I want you to put a 512 pitch roof. If it has a door in the center of the house, I want you to put a door in the center of the house. I want you to build it just like the pattern, except to scale. I want you to build me a model just like the pattern. And then you come along and hire the contractor, and you tell the contractor, I really don't care how you build the house. Well, that doesn't make any sense, does it? The point is that if you're going to make the model according to the pattern, how much more so the real and the true? That's the point of Hebrews 8 and in verse 5. That which was the model or the type, the tabernacle, had to be made according to a pattern. If that was true, how much more so the real and the true? The New Testament church has to be built according to the pattern of God. And there are other principles concerning Bible authority. We are to do all things in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, Colossians 3 and in verse 17. 2 John 9 says, as we've studied in detail in our study last week, we are to abide within the doctrine of Christ. So everything we do is to be found within the Scriptures. We are to abide within the doctrine, we're to do all things in the name of the Lord. So that's the principle of Bible authority. Now let's make some application of that. When it comes to an issue, whether it's a current issue among brethren or it's a future issue that we haven't faced yet, the question needs to be, what does the Word of the Lord say on this issue? You remember in our study on Wednesday night in Jeremiah 37 and verse 17, Zedekiah the king asked Jeremiah, is there any word from the Lord? That's a good question to ask. We need to raise the question, is there any word from the Lord on this issue? So when someone wants to introduce a new practice, we need to ask, what does the Lord say on this issue? What does the Bible teach on that? What does Bible authority say about this issue? Is it authorized or is it not? That's the first question always to raise. Secondly, the question needs to be raised, what is the Bible pattern for fellowship on this type of issue? Is this an issue where God doesn't care one way or another? There's a pattern for that. Is it an issue where God has spoken and forbidden something? Then there is a pattern for that. So is this a matter of liberty or indifference? Is it a matter of faith, doctrine, and morals? And so what is the Bible pattern with reference to fellowship? Now I want you to listen carefully to this point, and that is that respecting Bible authority for fellowship is just as important as respecting Bible authority for worship. God has a pattern for fellowship. That's just as important following that pattern as it is the pattern for worship. God has a pattern, and we're going to see that pattern as we unfold. Here's the second thing I want you to consider. Here's another principle that needs to be applied. First, we must have our actions must be based on authority. Secondly, unity must be based upon truth. I'll remind you of what we saw and the principle in our second lesson. And that is, unity is based upon truth. We saw that in John 17. Jesus prayed for unity. And three times in the context, he made an appeal to truth, like, thy word is truth. Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. And those who believe on me through your word. Three times he talks about truth in the context of a plea for unity. Furthermore, truth is the basis for fellowship. We saw that in John in verse 9, abiding within the doctrine of Christ. So here's how we take that principle and apply. The question is, are we teaching and practicing the same things? So here is one with whether we're going to extend fellowship to them. It's supporting a gospel preacher. Maybe it's having one for a gospel meeting. Maybe it's we're going to place membership with a local church somewhere. Are we teaching and practicing the same things? If we're teaching and practicing the same things, we can have fellowship. The question is our unity and our fellowship based upon truth, or is it based upon ignoring our differences? Can we have unity because we've ignored that we are different and we teach different doctrines? That's called unity and diversity, well practiced among brethren, even in our own day. Here's a third principle that we need to apply, and that is our reaction needs to be based upon the pattern. What do we mean, our reaction? When someone is a question of whether or not we're going to have fellowship with them, whether we're going to extend fellowship, whether we're going to continue fellowship, Our reaction must be based upon a pattern. We've looked at two patterns in this study. And I'm trying to tie all the loose ends together and bring these studies together with this concept. And that is that Romans 14, these are two different patterns. Romans 14 says we're to receive one. 2 John 9 says you're not to receive. Obviously, they're two different patterns. In Romans chapter 14, the issue was matters of indifference, where in 2 John 9, it was matters of faith and doctrine. Concerning matters of indifference, God receives him, so we're told to receive him too. In matters of faith and doctrine, God rejected him if it was contrary to the will of God, and we're to reject him too. And so we must follow, our reaction must follow the pattern of the New Testament. God has a pattern for fellowship. And so the question needs to be raised, what about the issue that's being raised? Does God care one way or another? If God doesn't care, then this is the pattern to follow. If it is a matter of faith and doctrine where God does care, then there's a pattern to follow. We need not forget those patterns. Now let's go back to those three principles. And I want to suggest to you that all too often we take those principles where our actions are based upon authority, unity based upon truth, reaction based upon the pattern, and they are forgotten, they are ignored, and they are disregarded if and when it's a friend or it's family. That often happens in friends and family circumstances, that we disregard the pattern, we disregard the principle, because now this is family or it's friends. It often comes about because when a brother that we like happens to be the one teaching error, then I don't want to apply the principles that are involved. What do we mean by that? Well, some of you are not old enough to remember the controversy of the late 80s over Brother Homer Haley. When Brother Homer Haley began teaching error on divorce and remarriage, it became public in 1988. Began in Belen, New Mexico, teaching an error concerning the divorce and remarriage question, teaching the alien sinner is not amenable to the law of Christ. He had held that for many years as a private view, but in 1988 he became public and then wrote a book on the subject. Well, as he became public, there were many who came to the defense of him because we like Brother Haley. He's highly esteemed as this great scholar among brethren, and so we extend fellowship to him. Why? Because he's a friend. We disregard the pattern, we disregard the principles, because we like the man. Or there are times when there are brethren who say, we're going to forget those principles because this brother who's teaching something that I think is wrong happens to be in my group. In the group wherein I write, in the magazine, or the group in which I circle, my association, or those that we happen to be close friends, he's in my group. And consequently, we're not going to break fellowship. So we often disregard those principles. If we're going to apply the principle of fellowship, the actions based upon authority, unity based upon truth, and our reaction based upon the pattern, we must take those principles and they must be applied. Secondly, now, we're trying to make application to controversy. There are some instructions that must be followed. And what do we mean by instructions? Well, the question is, what kind of instructions were given both in the Old and New Testaments concerning dealing with sin and error? Was ever there a description given in the Old Testament that you should accept one teaching error? You should accept one practicing error? Was there ever any instruction that you should tolerate teaching of error in the New Testament? Or was the instruction always to reject it and correct it? Let's see what the answer to the question is. In the Old Testament, sin and error was not to be accepted. In the Old Testament, sin and error was not to be accepted. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, let's take the book of Jeremiah. That's familiar to us, because Jeremiah, we've been studying, and we're about chapter 38 or 39 in our studies on Wednesday nights. And so this ought to be familiar ground. Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 11, Jeremiah 3 and in verse 1, Jeremiah 5 and verse 7, we won't read all of those passages. Each one of those shows that they had gone into apostasy because they had committed idolatry. And so now they're bowing down and they're worshiping idols. I'll take the time to read those. There were efforts made, according to Jeremiah 2 and in verse 29, to justify that. There were some among the people of God who sought to justify that, and they would say the kinds of things you read in Jeremiah 2 and verse 29. Why will you plead with me, God said? You have transgressed against me. In other words, they're claiming innocence. Well, we haven't really done anything wrong, so they're trying to justify their actions. Well, furthermore, in the book of Jeremiah, there were false prophets who came along and preached acceptance. They would preach peace, peace, where there was no peace. They said Jeremiah's all wrong about this thing of doom and destruction and about Babylonian captivity. None of that's going to happen. So Jeremiah chapter 5, Jeremiah chapter 6, Jeremiah chapter 8 talks about all the false prophets that came along saying all is well and peace, peace, where there was no peace. But I want to suggest to you that the answer to the problem was never, you won't find anywhere in the book of Jeremiah or any of the prophets, where God has said accept it or tolerate it, but the answer always was correct the problem and amend your ways. Look at Jeremiah chapter 7 and in verse 3. Jeremiah 7 and in verse 3 said, here was God's answer to the problem, amend your ways and your doings. We saw just recently in Jeremiah 36 and in verse 3 and in verse 7, God said that if they perhaps hear the word, write it down so that they might read, it just may be they'll hear it and they'll repent and they turn from their ways. God's answer to sin and the error was corrected. It never was to tolerate that. That's an instruction that we ought to take heed to. Well, let's see if it's any different in the New Testament. In the New Testament, sin and error was never to be accepted. Let's take the case at Corinth. What was going on at Corinth? Well, there was one who was in adultery, wherein he had his father's wife. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. There was also a problem with the perversion of the Lord's Supper. They were abusing the Lord's Supper. It was erroneous. That was sinful. Secondly, or thirdly, there was the misuse of the spiritual gifts in 1 Corinthians chapters 12, 13, and 14. There was squabbling within the church. So there's sin within the church. There was error that was being taught on the resurrection. There were some saying that there was no resurrection from the dead. So here is error being taught. Here is sin being practiced. This is a church riddled with all kinds of problems. The answer was not to accept it, not to tolerate it, but it was to correct it. Look at 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 13. Put away from yourselves that wicked person. That was God's answer to the problem. Don't tolerate it. Don't embrace it. But put away from yourselves that wicked person. 1 Corinthians 15, 33, this was in the context of the error being taught that evil communications corrupts good manners. Don't associate with those teachers of error, they'll corrupt your good morals. So the answer always was, as it was in the Old Testament, correct it, don't accept it. Let's take the case at Rome. The book of Romans addresses the error of Judaism. It's addressed all through the book. Chapter 3 talks about the doctrine of Judaism that says we're to go back into the Old Testament law. The answer was, not to accept it, but to correct it. Mark those who cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine. Let's take another case. Let's take the case in Asia, that is, the seven churches of Asia. Several of those churches had problems. There was doctrinal error. There was the doctrine of Balaam and the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. It was tolerated. There was not only the doctrine, there was the moral sins of fornication that was tolerated in chapter 2 and in verse 14. What was the answer? You read the seven letters, and here's the answer. It was not accepted. It was not embrace it. It wasn't tolerated, but corrected. And the passages in chapter 2, for example, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. There was the plea repeatedly in chapter 2, verse 16, 2 and verse 22, to repent, or else I will come quickly. God's answer to the error and to the sin was, correct it, repent, and turn from that. I want to suggest to you, you listen to this carefully. There is no instruction in the Old or New Testament to receive or accept the practice of sin. You won't find that anywhere. You won't find it in Romans 14. You don't find it in 2 John 9, two passages that have been abused to teach that. Furthermore, you won't find any instructions to receive or accept doctrinal diversity. Never in the Old Testament was Jeremiah said, let these other prophets teach what they want and embrace them, and don't call them false teachers. Furthermore, you won't find any instruction to receive or accept diversity of morals, and you won't find any instruction to receive and accept teachers of error. Now, that's being practiced among brethren, but you won't find that any instruction anywhere in the New Testament. So there are instructions that need to be followed. Thirdly, I want to spend most of the rest of our time talking about the efforts that must be resisted. And what do we mean by efforts that are to be resisted? There have been efforts to broaden the scope of fellowship. We've already looked at some of those, taking Romans 14 and trying to make it broader than what it is. And we're repeatedly bombarded with Romans 14 through the years. And even today, we're hearing much about Romans 14. What are some of the efforts to broaden the scope of fellowship? Well, I want to list four that we haven't directly addressed thus far. One is to redefine fellowship. G.K. Wallace correctly said that if you allow a false teacher to create his own vocabulary, his arguments will be unanswerable. I say amen. If you let a teacher of error define his own terms, then his arguments are unanswerable. And that has been done with the matter of fellowship. And here's how that's done. Some are taking the word fellowship. That's why we spent time in the first lesson. You wonder, why do we spend so much time defining fellowship? There's a reason. It's because of the abuse of the term. There are some who say we can have fellowship in matters wherein we agree, but not fellowship the error that's taught. So here's a man who teaches error. We'll have him for a gospel meeting. We'll support him out of the church treasury. And you say, well, how can you have, oh, we're not having fellowship in the error. We don't do that at all. We fellowship in the things that we agree. We just don't fellowship him in the error that he teaches. See, we told him we disagreed with him. Well, that's not what 2 John 9, if a man comes and doesn't bring this doctrine, do not receive him. Doesn't say receive him, but just tell him he's wrong. Don't receive him. That's not what 2 John 9 said. Some have said fellowship is merely a local church matter, and so there's no fellowship beyond a local church. I won't mention some of the names, but some of the well-known names that you would recognize that have been leading on the broader side of fellowship, I've talked to personally and confronted them when I'd hear them speak, and their argument has been, some of them at least, is there is no fellowship beyond a local church. Well, what about 2 Corinthians 4 and 8 and verse 4? When the churches of Macedonia and the churches of Achaia were sending contribution to help the needy saints at Jerusalem, not in the same local church, that was called fellowship, verse 4, koinonia, fellowship, that's what it was called. In Philippians 1, when the church at Philippi had sent once and again unto Paul, they had sent him fellowship, Philippians 1 and verse 5. It was called fellowship in chapter 4. So when we support men like James Buchanan, we read about a few moments ago, we're having fellowship with him. He's not a member of this church. He's in South Africa. He's a member of a different local church. And all these men that we're supporting, we're having fellowship with them. They're not in this local church. It's not a local church matter. You allow them to redefine fellowship, and they're allowed to teach their error. And even more recently than some of those, there are some who are using the term associate. They quit using the term fellowship. We'll associate with him. We don't fellowship him. We just associate with him. And here's a new one that's been used in the last 10 years or so, and that is we want to reach out. We need to reach out to brethren with whom we disagree. Well, I'll agree with that. We need to reach out. But what they mean by reaching out is having fellowship. Took me a while to figure that one out. Don't you think we need to reach out? Well, yeah, I think we ought to reach out to them. And I thought we were reaching out to have a discussion. They're talking about reaching out and having fellowship is what they mean by that. What we saw from 2 Corinthians 6 is that fellowship, koinonia, has to do with an agreement in principle leading to joint or common action in spiritual work. We are not allowed to redefine fellowship. But here's another one that's been used for a while. We redefine false teacher. And so here's the idea of a false teacher. The question is a false teacher one who teaches error and false doctrine, or is it one who is dishonest? That's the question. You probably always thought a false teacher was one who taught a false doctrine, but brethren have redefined false teacher to be one who is dishonest. And so when Brother Haley taught his doctrine a few years ago, that's where the doctrine, this concept began to develop among brethren. When he began to teach his doctrine, those who were his close friends said, well, you don't consider him a false teacher. Well, do you think he's, oh yeah, I think he's wrong about what he teaches. I think he's in error about what he teaches, but he's not a false teacher. Well, why is he not a false teacher? It's because he's not dishonest. A false teacher is dishonest. And so if he's honestly teaching his doctrine, then he's not a false teacher. So we won't reject him because he's a false teacher. Well, the consequence of that is an honest man couldn't be a false teacher. So if I stood before you and honestly believe Jesus is not the Son of God, and I taught that tonight, the other elders couldn't fire me because I'm not a false teacher. They couldn't make the charge I'm a false teacher because I honestly believe that. That would also mean, as a consequence, that the teacher's attitude makes all the difference. Let's see how that works. Here is a doctrine we all would agree is a false doctrine, and that is that the guilty party can remarry. In a case where a man has committed adultery and his wife puts him away for his adultery, that the Bible teaches he can't remarry, but there are those who say he can. That's error and that's false. Well, here's a man who teaches that doctrine, and here's another man who teaches the same doctrine. Now, this man is dishonest. He knows that to be error. But the reason he's teaching it is he's preaching for a church that'll pay him to teach that. But this man over here is honest because he honestly believes that to be the truth. Well, here comes a couple along who listens to this man preach, and they remarry contrary to the scriptures based on his teaching. Here's a couple that they remarry based upon his teaching. Now, my question is, which couple is in adultery? Which one? If you can't figure out, both of them are in adultery, aren't they? Now, did it make any difference? A man who was honest taught this couple, and a man who was dishonest taught this couple. They're both false teachers because they taught falsely. But the concept is we can have fellowship with this man over here. We can't fellowship this man, though we cannot fellowship either one of the couples whom they taught to engage in the sin. Let a man redefine false teachers, and we can fellowship anyone. Now, how do we know a man is a false teacher? Let's turn in our Bibles to 1 John chapter 4 and verse 1. You say, well, this is not a big issue for me right now. Well, it may be in the future when another issue arises, and maybe it's one of your friends that you respect and someone's calling him a false teacher, how are you going to know if he's a false teacher or not? Well, 1 John 4 and verse 1 and verse 6 answers that for me. Verse 1 says, try the spirits whether they are of God, for many false prophets are gone out into the world. There is such a thing as a false prophet. How do we know? Verse 6, we are of God, he who knows God hears us. The us is the apostles. The context bears that out. He that is not of God does not hear us. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Here's how you tell the difference in truth and error. If he agrees with the teaching of the apostles who were inspired, it is the truth. If it disagrees with the apostles, it is error. That's how you try the spirits. So back to these two men on the screen that was before us. And so how do I know which one's a false teacher? I check it by what the apostles taught, about what was revealed in the scriptures. And if it doesn't fit the scriptures, then he's a false teacher. That's what 1 John chapter 4 and verse 6 says. Now, it is contended that false teachers are dishonest based on 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2 talks about some false teachers. And the argument is made that in verse 3 and in verse 10, 2 Peter chapter 2, were dishonest men. And we grant for argument's sake, they were dishonest men. But let's analyze that. I want to suggest to you that both before chapter 2, in chapter 1, for example, and after chapter 2, like in chapter 3, there was emphasis given to an adherence to the word and to the truth, more so than attitude. Look at verse 1 of 2 Peter chapter 2 and in verse 1. A false teacher is compared to a false prophet. There are also false prophets among the people, speaking of the Old Testament times, as there will be false teachers among you. That has a reference to Old Testament prophets. Do you know that expression is not used in the Old Testament anywhere? I don't think you'll find that in the Old Testament. You'll find false prophets, but I don't think you'll find the expression of them ever being called a false prophet. What's the significance of that? How do I know they were a false prophet? I know they were a false prophet by what they taught, not the attitude they had. The false teacher was compared to a false prophet. He taught false doctrine like we saw in Jeremiah 5 and verse 31. Now I want you to go back to verse 1. Those who were the false teachers compared to false prophets, what made them their false teachers is they were teaching destructive or damnable heresy. They were teaching destructive doctrine, doctrine that led people into sin. If it is a doctrine that leads people into sin and leads people contrary to the will of God, it is a false doctrine. Here's another argument that's made to broaden the scope of fellowship, historical consistency. It has been argued that brethren through the years had unity in spite of differences over issues like divorce and remarriage. When the issue of divorce and remarriage came up, one of the things that was argued that we ought to continue to have fellowship even though we teach different doctrines is because the practice through the years has been we've had unity and diversity over that. What that does is that makes brethren the standard and not the truth. Has us thinking of men above that which is written, 1 Corinthians 4 and in verse 6. There were brethren who had fellowship in spite of instrumental music issues in the 1800s. I'll mention that in closing in just a few moments. Does that mean that needs to be our standard? Obviously not. History doesn't change 2 John in verse 9 through 11. It doesn't matter what we've practiced in history. 2 John 9 said if he doesn't abide in the doctrine of Christ, he doesn't have God, and we're not to receive such a one as in that context. Furthermore, I want to suggest to you that here's another contention, an effort, and that is local church autonomy. It is argued that if we begin to refuse fellowship to someone or warn of the teachers of error, that's a violation of local church autonomy. In other words, if there is a teacher of error in another county from here or even across town from here or in another state and we warned of that false teacher, we're violating local church autonomy. Self-government is what autonomy refers to. What that does is that makes the local church the standard, a subjective standard, rather than the truth, the standard of God. And so we determine that by local churches. I want to suggest to you that in Galatians 1 in verse 7 and 5 and in verse 12, Paul warned the churches of Galatia. That was more than one church. And if he was a member, and he wasn't a member of those churches, but if he was a member of even one of those churches, he would have not been a member of every one of them. He warned those churches, plural, even though he wasn't a member there. That didn't violate local church autonomy. All he was doing was warning them about sin and about error. And that's what he did in the book of Galatians. Now listen to this carefully as I suggest to you. That being tolerant of error and false teachers, whether it's broadening the scope of Romans 14, making it broader, or narrowing the scope of false teacher and narrowing the scope of fellowship, here's the point of all this. You say, what's the big deal? The point of all of that is so that the false teacher can basically say, don't call me a false teacher or cut off fellowship or cut off my support because you think my doctrine is wrong, you allow me to teach what I want. And so if the principles that we've been talking about are true, what that means is I could stand before you tonight and I could teach that Jesus is not the Son of God, or I could teach error on divorce and remarriage. And when the elders want to cut off fellowship and they want to cut off my support and get me out of the pulpit, the cry would be, Romans 14 comes to play, I'm not a false teacher, allow me to teach my error and let me get by with that and don't cut me off. That's what that says. And that's happening among brethren. Now here's the last thing. I know our time is about gone, but I want to close with some warnings. There are warnings that must be heeded. As we make application of the principle of fellowship, we need to take heed to some warnings. We need to be aware of drifting, because drifting takes place among brethren. The winds of change are blowing among brethren. And it may be that you're sitting here tonight and you say, I'd rather hear a lesson on the parables, which we're going to get into soon, or something that encourages me instead of something about fellowship, and I don't know much about this. I want to tell you, the winds of change are blowing among brethren. And what I mean by that is the departure of the present day differs from the departures of the past. There was a day when an issue came up, like instrumental music or the missionary society, the church, parachurch organizations. It was quite clear which churches were going in which direction and which were going in a different direction. But the apostasy of the day, much like the war we're fighting in our country, is different from the past. It's a different kind of battle. The kinds of things we're seeing among brethren is softer preaching. We see looseness on worldliness. We're blurring the lines of individual roles and churches' roles and advertisements concerning meetings and social events. We have problems with confusion over cordiality and excitement. And we confuse that with spirituality. Because there is excitement and brethren are friendly, we think they're spiritually minded, and that may not be the case. We have issues over divorce and remarriage and multiple causes of divorce. We've had brethren who've cast doubt on the credibility of the Genesis account, who question whether or not that is an inspired account. And some brethren have argued that Genesis 1 is a matter of fiction borrowed from pagan myths and been taught in some of the schools. There are claims that we're not living under law. The winds of change are blowing. And I want to suggest to you that the danger is churches and individuals and preachers are changing gradually. I want you to bear with this principle of Hebrews 2 and in verse 1. I know our time is about gone. But Hebrews 2 and verse 1 says, apostasy comes gradually and slowly. We ought to give the morning's heed to the things that we've heard, lest we drift away. Drifting is like drifting in a boat. It happens slowly and gradually. Lest we let them slip, the King James says, or the footnote says, run out as a leaking vessel. Describes a slow, gradual process. Perhaps you've seen this illustration before. I've used it many times. But it gets the point. For illustration's sake, let's just suppose that in order to worship God that the Bible teaches, I know it doesn't, but let's just for illustration's sake suppose it does, that in order to worship God we have to have a black square in the front of the building. For whatever reason, that's just the law of God, to have a black square in the front of the building when we worship. And over a period of time, one of the deacons who sees to that and maintains that for us has polished it or rubbed it to the point that it took 5 years and it's not that black opaque anymore. Now, if we come in one Sunday and it's like this, and the next Sunday it's that, we'll probably split. But that took 5 years to get to that point. It took 5 years. And we hardly noticed the change. 5 more years, it looks like this. That's lighter than this, but there's not a lot of difference in the 5th and the 10th year. But remember, it took 5 more years to get to that point. And then by 15, and then 20, and then 25. And there's a big difference in 25 in the black, but it took us 25 years to get there. That young man of 25 years old is now 50 years old who remembers that black square. And there's some that don't remember black squares anymore because it's been 25 years. 30 and then 35 and then 40 and 45 and then 50. And by 55 years, we gradually change. There's no 2 5-year periods that look a lot different, but there's a big difference in a black square and a white square. It just took 55 years. It just took 55 years. That's not a long time. In the mind of some of you, 55 years is a long time. But you ask some of the older heads, 55 years went by pretty fast. 55 years. That was in the 60s. Now we're used to white squares, and we forgot about the black square. We've got new deacons in charge, and they polished it so much that the corners begin to wear off. But that looks like a square, and so I can accept. I'm not going to have a fit over that. But it took 5 years to get to that point. And in interest of time, it took five more years and five more years until finally, within 110 years, we've come down to a white circle. It's all it took was 100 years. And we've gone from a black square to a white circle. I don't know if you can tell, but that looks like there's a lot of difference between a black square and a white circle. But it didn't get there overnight. The winds of change are blowing. That's why fellowship is so important. We need to understand there are false teachers among us. All the false teachers are not in the world. Not all the false teachers are in denominationalism. There are false teachers among us. Acts 20 and verse 30, Paul warned the elders of the church at Ephesus. 2 Peter 2 and verse 1 was talking about false teachers among us, among God's people. You need to know the text in its context. Open your Bible to 2 Peter chapter 3. You wonder why sometimes when we're studying, say, the book of Romans, the book of Galatians, the book of Corinthians, the book of Ephesians, and we're going verse by verse, whether it's in a pulpit or in the Bible class, and you're saying, why do I need to know all of this stuff? I won't tell you why you need to know. 2 Peter chapter 3 and in verse 16, I do not apologize for repeating a point you've heard many times. And if you don't have some notes written in the margin of your text about these three verses, it might be a good time to do that. Verse 16. Paul wrote some things in his epistles which are hard to understand, which those who are untaught and unstable twist to their own destruction as they also do the rest of the scriptures. The scriptures will be perverted to teach error, verse 16. That's the point. Verse 17, the danger. Beware lest you fall from your own steadfastness. They could easily influence you with their error. Verse 18, here's the answer and the preventative to the problem. But grow in the grace and the knowledge of the Lord. You know, and I'm convinced the text is talking about knowing the text in its context, because that's how I know the perversion of verse 16. How do I know he's perverting? Because I know my text in the context. And that's why it's important to understand what Romans is about and what Romans 8 is about and how Romans 7 fits with Romans 8 and how the context bears out the understanding of the chapter. So that when someone comes along and takes a passage and teaches and abuses that text, I know from the context he's abused that. What I'm suggesting to you as a well-informed church is insulated against apostasy. A well-informed church is insulated against apostasy. And the last thing, and then we're done. Here's a warning that needs to be heeded. Realize that compromise will not work. There is a common idea that I can teach against a doctrine while fellowshipping those who teach and practice it. I have good friends who have fellowshipped those in error. All the while they're reaching out a hand to fellowship, they're saying, I'm telling them they're wrong, I'm telling them they're wrong, I'm telling them they're wrong. I've told them I don't agree with them. I told them I don't approve of what they're teaching. And the common idea is that I can teach against a doctrine while fellowshipping those who teach error and teach error. 2 John 9 says that's not so. But I want to close with a warning from those who tried and it failed. The churches in the 1930s and the 1940s were riddled with the problem of premillennialism. Most of us are too young to know what went on in those days. We only know it by history. But in the 1930s and 1940s, coming out of Louisville, Kentucky, that was the source. Error was being taught among brethren. I'm not talking about denominationalism, among brethren, on premillennialism. These two men stood for the truth, Roy Coghlan and Foy Wallace Jr. And they were the ones when there was a problem that brethren called on them to come and battle the issue. But unless that battle was being fought, they didn't have any use for men like that. And what I want to suggest to you is that during that time and shortly after the premillennialism controversy, many churches rejected the doctrine. They didn't believe that, but they didn't want preaching against it. Coghlan himself would say that there are many places he went, they would tell him, we don't want to hear preaching against premillennialism. We don't believe that doctrine, but we don't want to hear all this preaching y'all been doing against premillennialism. We're not plagued with that. We don't want y'all to be preaching against premillennialism here. They didn't believe the doctrine to be true, but they didn't want preaching against it. Coghlan's observation, not one of those churches, not a single one of those churches stood when the issues arose in the 1950s and 60s. They were compromisers. It didn't work. J.W. McGarvey tried it. He taught against instrumental music while at the same time fellowshipping those who did. And I won't read the entire quotation, but this is from J.P. Sewell, who was a young man when McGarvey was an old man, and he said, McGarvey sat down beside him on the front of a church pew, and he said, I want to give you a piece of advice, he said, and this is what the quotation bears out. Stand where you're standing and keep standing. Don't try to compromise, because I've tried and it didn't work. He talks about teaching people in the College of the Bible. The College of the Bible was a small school that he started teaching the Bible which you may not know anything about the College of the Bible, but it later became what you may recognize as the University of Kentucky, UK, was started by J.W. McGarvey to teach the Bible, far cry from what it is now. But the men who came through what is now UK, he would teach them against instrumental music. But he was fellowshipping those who did. He went and held meetings where they did, and he worked and associated with those. And he said, I know, I don't know more than six of those men that I ever taught who's standing for the truth today. Fellowshipping era just doesn't work. Henry Ficklin was one of McGarvey's students. And someone asked him, do you know of anyone that he ever converted by his talking against it, though he fellowshipped? And he said, no, I can't remember a single man. Not a single one ever changed. It was because he didn't teach as consistently as he ought, and he didn't back it up with his presence. Here's the lesson learned. We cannot combat error by fellowshipping it, because when we do, our influence will go with our fellowship and not with our doctrine. It'll go with our fellowship and not our doctrine. And so you start fellowshipping sin, or you start fellowshipping error, and you tell your children about how wrong that is, they're not going to listen to what you say. They're going to pay attention to what you do, and your influence is going to go with your fellowship. It always does. It always has. McGarvey failed. So what have we seen? Principles that need to be applied, instructions that must be followed, efforts that must be resisted, and warnings that we must take heed to. And may God help us to understand the principles of fellowship and how to apply those as we talk about controversies now and in the future. There may be one or more present tonight who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come all together? We stand and while we sing.